THE SHUTTLE by Francis Hodgson Burnett CHAPTER I THE WEAVING OF THE SHUTTLE No man knew when the shuttle began its slow and heavy weaving from shore to shore that it was held and guided by the great hand of fate. Fate alone saw the meaning of the web it wove, the might of it and its place in the making of a world's history. Men thought but little of either web or weaving, calling them by other names and lighter ones, for the time unconscious of the strength of the thread thrown across thousands of miles of leaping, heaving grey or blue ocean. Fate and life planned the weaving, and it seemed mere circumstance which guided the shuttle to and fro between two worlds, divided by a gulf broader and deeper than the thousands of miles of salt, fierce sea, the gulf of a bitter quarrel deepened by hatred and the shedding of brothers' blood. Between the two worlds of east and west there was no will to draw nearer, each held apart. Those who had rebelled against that which their souls called tyranny, having struggled madly and shed blood in tearing themselves free, turned stern backs upon their unconquered enemies, broke all cords that bound them to the past, flinging off ties of name, kinship and rank, beginning with fierce disdain a new life. Those who, being rebelled against, found the rebels too passionate in their determination and too desperate in their defence of their strongholds to be less than unconquerable, sailed back haughtily to the world which seemed so far the greater power. Plunging into new battles, they added new conquests and splendour to their land, looking back with something of contempt to the half-savage West, left to build its own civilization without other aid than the strength of its own strong right hand and strong uncultured brain. But while the two worlds held apart, the shuttle, weaving slowly in the great hand of fate, drew them closer and held them firm, each of them all unknowing for many a year that what had first been mere threads of gossamer was forming a web whose strength in time none could compute, whose severance could be accomplished but by tragedy and convulsion. The weaving was but in its early and slow-moving years when this story opens. Steamers crossed and recrossed the Atlantic, but they accomplished the journey at leisure and with heavy rollings and all such discomforts as small craft can afford. Their staterooms and decks were not crowded with people to whom the voyage was a mere incident, in many cases a yearly one. A crossing in those days was an event. It was planned seriously, long thought of, discussed and rediscussed, with and among the various members of the family to whom the voyager belonged. A certain boldness, bordering on recklessness, was almost to be presupposed in the individual who, turning his back upon New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and like cities, turned his face towards Europe. In those days, when the shuttle wove at leisure, a man did not lightly run over to London or Paris or Berlin. He gravely went to Europe. The journey being likely to be made once in a lifetime, the traveller's intention was to see as much as possible, to visit as many cities, cathedrals, ruins, galleries, as his time and purse would allow. People who could speak with any degree of familiarity of Hyde Park, the Champs-Élysées, the Pincio, had gained a certain dignity. The ability to touch with an intimate bearing upon such localities was a raison de plus for being asked out to tea or to dinner. To possess photographs and relics was to be of interest, to have seen European celebrities even at a distance, to have wandered about the outside of poets' gardens and philosophers' houses was to be entitled to respect. The period was a far cry from the time when the shuttle, having shot to and fro, faster and faster, week by week, month by month, weaving new threads into its web each year, has woven warp and woof until they bind far shore to shore. It was in comparatively early days that the first thread we follow was woven into the web. Many such have been woven since, and have added greater strength than any others, twining the cord of sex and home-building and race-founding. But this was a slight and weak one, being only the thread of the life of one of Reuben Vanderpool's daughters, the pretty little simple one whose name was Rosalie. They were, the Vanderpools, of the Americans whose fortunes were a portion of the history of their country. The building of these fortunes had been a part of or had created epochs and crises. Their millions could scarcely be regarded as private property. Newspapers bandied them about, so to speak, employing them as factors in argument, using them as figures of speech, incorporating them into methods of calculation.